United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having any manner or form of business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, are admonished to draw nigh and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court.
Good morning. Please be seated. We're happy to hear your argument in our first case, number 104119, United States versus Mackenzie Good. Mr. Bayer.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
May it please the court. The primary issue before the court today involves the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule. Excuse me, and in particular, whether the exception applies under the circumstances of this case. We would submit to your honors that any reasonably well-trained police officer would have known that this search was illegal despite the magistrate's authorization. In the words of Leon, the officer would have no reasonable grounds for believing the warrant was properly issued because it was so lacking in indicia of probable cause as to render official belief in its existence entirely unreasonable.
Well, Mr. Bayer, you started out with any reasonable police officer would have known that he didn't have a basis here. The reasonable police officers, in fact, knew facts would have given them a basis for this search. The government's problem here is that they didn't put that in their affidavits.
Exactly, Your Honor.
So we don't really have a question of whether we can look at this, you know, like God looking down on all of us. We can look at this as a picture, and we can see the police officer, and we can say any reasonable police officer that knew what they knew would know that he had a reasonable basis for a search. But our question is whether he had to tell the magistrate that in order to get the search warrant, and if it's failure to give the magistrate judge that information, and what do you rely on that would get you there? Because the case law talks about the police officer's reasonable belief.
Well, I think, Your Honor, I think if we go back to Leon itself, I think Leon sets up several premises. One is that the information that we're looking at is within the four corners of the affidavit, and I think that's pretty bedrock Fourth Amendment law, unless we're talking about a Frank situation or some other type of situation. Ordinarily, whether it's in this context or any context, when a reviewing court is looking at probable cause to issue a search warrant, that court is confined to the four corners of the affidavit. And I think in the context of Leon, the Supreme Court was setting up a premise that any police officer, whether it's the police officer who applies for the warrant or the police officer who executes the warrant, is looking at the information contained in the affidavit. So I think it's clear that when you apply an objective test, not a subjective test, we have to look at what is the information that was before the issuing magistrate. So I think...
But you agree with me. I don't think you can do anything but agree with me that objectively, not just subjectively, objectively, the police officers here did have a reasonable basis for the search.
Well, the ones who applied for the warrant, that's true.
Right.
That's true. As a matter of fact, we know from outside of the affidavit that they knew that the father was that Joe Goody was the father of Colin Mackenzie Goody, and they knew that they both lived at the Rockhurst Road address. But that's not really.
You're saying in doing the Leon analysis, we can't consider that.
You cannot consider it.
All right. The proposition that Judge Watts was explaining to you is that the reasonable police officer actually knew more than was in the affidavit. You know, there's authority that you can't consider that.
Well, that's correct. And of course, sometimes it's going to depend on the coincidence of who applies for the warrant versus who executes the warrant.
Whether it's the same person or not.
Right. Doesn't matter whether it's the same person. If you look at Leon and Whiteley versus Warden.
It does, in fact, no more than is in the affidavit. And that additional information gives him a reasonable basis for going forward, for acting in good faith, then he acted in good faith, if it's really a good faith test.
Well, I think that goes back to
he has to look at the...
Well, I'm... What do you say? See, I think that...
Well, I think that's...
We're talking about good faith, and you've acknowledged that they had good faith.
Subjectively.
They had a reason... Well, no, objectively.
I don't believe they did, Your Honor. They did not objectively.
They objectively had good faith. They had a basis we've all recognized for the search.
Well, but they needed to get a properly issued and properly executed warrant. They can't go to the house and say...
You've moved to a different point. If you could just stay with us for just a moment about what they knew as the basis for the search. What is your argument? What is your argument with respect to the good faith, since we know that they objectively had sufficient information to form the basis of probable cause?
Well, my argument is that you can't look to what was in the officer's mind subjectively. You have to look to what information is in the warrant itself. And I think my further support for this, and it's the case we cited in the brief, is the Supreme Court case of Groh versus Ramirez. Now, it's in a slightly different context, but I think it's extremely analogous.
Tell me about that.
In Groh versus Ramirez, the Officer Groh had reason to believe that the Ramirez residence contained weapons, that they had a stockpile of weapons. In fact, the charge that he originally was investigating was the same as the one here. So he got a warrant, and in the application for the warrant, he described both the place to be searched and the things to be seized with particularity in the application, but forgot or made a mistake. There was some mistake that was made in the warrant itself. So in the warrant itself, they failed to identify any items to be seized. All right, so Supreme Court, so then they do the search, they don't find anything, so it turns into a Bivens civil rights case rather than a motion to suppress. So the officer was saying, well, wait a second, I subjectively knew, if you look at my application, I put in there the place to be searched and the things to be seized, so, you know, you can tell that I knew that. The Supreme Court says, well, no, the warrant itself was defective because you didn't list anything to be seized, and the application was not incorporated into the warrant, so it doesn't save it. It's a defective warrant. We have to ignore the application. It's as if the application doesn't exist. We can only look to the four corners of the warrant itself. Pardon me?
Is the court allowed a Bivens action?
Yes. The court not only allowed a Bivens action, the Supreme Court found that the officer was not entitled to qualified immunity because no reasonable officer could believe that the warrant was valid. So it's essentially the same. Pardon me? Groh versus Ramirez. It's in our brief and our reply brief.
I'm sure it is.
540 U.S. 551. It's a 2004 decision. So I think it's extremely analogous to this situation because, of course, the tests are similar in terms of whether you would be able to assert a defense of qualified immunity in the same way that here. Whether this is a bare bones affidavit that no reasonable police officer could rely on.
If I could just go back to Leon for just a moment to make sure I understand your argument. Leon sets forth several circumstances which justify suppression of evidence, under which reliance on a deficient warrant can't be reasonable. Of those circumstances, you seem to be relying on the fact that the officer is relying on a warrant based on an affidavit so lacking in indicia of probable cause as to render the official belief in its existence unreasonable.
Yes.
Okay. And as the questions keep positing, the officers had – this does not appear to fit the facts in front of us because the officers – had objectively knew the facts that would have created probable cause. There seems to be some degree of consensus on that point. So how does that particular circumstance fit the Leon exception?
Well, it fits the Leon exception because if you look at the typical situation, the court is wanting to set up a construct where if a police officer is going to execute a warrant it's incumbent on the police officer to read the warrant and to make sure basic things, just those four basic things in Leon, that, you know, to make sure it's outside, that's one of these, it's that the warrant is not one of these outlier cases. So we can only look to what is in the warrant itself and the affidavit if it's incorporated with it. And of course here, I think it's at JA 17, I believe, there's nothing that links the residence or this particular address to anything. It doesn't link it to Joe Goody. It doesn't link it to evidence of this crime. It doesn't link it to Colin McKenzie Goody. So this court has made clear in cases like U.S. versus Williams and U.S. versus Lawler and U.S. versus Perez that there has to be probable cause. There's a probable cause component and, of course, a nexus component in the search warrant. I think that the most analogous case factually to this is a case of U.S. versus Holt from this court from 2006, where there's no connection between very little connection between Holt and the premises that were searched. I guess the two cases that are the most analogous for the point Your Honor has raised about you can't look outside of the warrant is U.S. versus Gonzalez, which is a Tenth Circuit case, and U.S. versus Hove, which is a Ninth Circuit case. But I still think that the Groh versus Ramirez case, which postdates this court's...
The difference there was it didn't describe anything that should be, that was to be seized.
Correct.
Right? That was its problem.
Right.
It didn't describe anything that was to be seized.
That's correct.
Here, there's a detailed list of things to be seized.
Oh, sure. Sure. But, of course, I guess my point, Your Honor, is that here it's, again, so completely bare bones that any reasonable police officer would know, looking at this warrant, that there's no nexus. It's not even a tenuous nexus. There's no nexus. So with no nexus, that's tantamount to any of those other facial defects, like we don't know what place to search, we don't know what things to seize, whatever.
Well, Groh involved the lack of particularity as to the scope of the search, right?
Well, as to anything, it didn't say what was to be searched, what was to be seized.
Well, we know here what was to be seized.
Oh, sure, sure.
So what we are lacking is only the address.
Well, we have the address, where we have the place.
The fact that this person lived at this address.
Exactly.
That's the only thing we're lacking.
Now, it mentioned, mentioned the name of his father. It didn't say it was his father.
Right. They have slightly different last names. I mean,
has the same last name.
Right. Well, not the same last name.
And the officers knew it was his father.
They did.
They knew that he lived there.
They knew we lived there. They knew all kinds of things. But again, I think if you go back to Leon and
we can't go there.
Right. Unfortunately, I think that the point is that the Supreme Court is recognizing that because this is an objective standard and you have to look at only the four corners of the affidavit, that basically the police, and this is obviously a very unusual extreme circumstance. This is not the typical case, but for this particular defect, it would have been probably a valid warrant. It was pretty slim affidavit, but there was enough there, other than the total lack of a nexus. So any reasonably trained officer would have looked at this warrant and said, well, wait a second, there's some problem here because There's no connection between this residence and the Goody family. So, I guess you wonder, well, why did the judge issue it? He should have seen it too, but he didn't. It passed by him somehow, and that's what we're left with.
What do you make of our Bynum case?
Well, I know the issue was raised in Bynum about whether just this it's this very issue.
So I thought maybe we could talk about that.
So, and I guess my thought about Bynum, Your Honor, is Bynum was decided, I believe, in 2002, and Groh versus Ramirez.
You think that Groh is the answer?
I think so. Groh comes 2 years after Bynum. I think if this court had had the benefit of Groh, there might have been a very different analysis. I think, Your Honor, in your opinion, you don't really reach the issue, ultimately, because you found that the good faith exception applied, and regardless. So I think the answer is Groh to this issue.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. I notice you don't cite Groh in your brief. Maybe you can talk to us about it.
Certainly, Your Honor. I'll begin by doing exactly that. Groh versus Ramirez is, simply put, it's a red herring here. The Groh decision, as the court is aware, involved a deficiency in the actual search warrant itself. And what we're talking about in the incident case is a question with respect to the affidavit. In Groh, the Supreme Court actually noted that the Fourth Amendment, by its very terms, requires particularity in the warrant itself. And so the problem in Groh was that the failure to describe the items to be seized, it had the effect of depriving respondents, the victims of the search, of any means to challenge the officers with respect to the scope of what they were doing when they came to the house. That's not the case that's presented here at all. In this case, as Your Honor noted earlier, the location to be searched is described distinctly, and the items to be seized are described in particular with particularity. And so Groh is a red herring because it's focused on the question of particularity, and that's not the issue here. The problem with this warrant, as this court is aware, is one of whether or not there's sufficient nexus linking the individuals named in the warrant with the location to be searched. And the government's readily going to concede that they should have included an additional sentence linking Colin McKenzie Goode to the house. If they had done a sentence like that, explains the stuff that we all agree here today that they in fact knew. If they had simply included a sentence, then we wouldn't be here today. But they didn't do that. And so the question becomes whether or not the reliance on that affidavit by the officer was objectively reasonable. I submit that it is, because even looking at this affidavit, it's certainly not a great affidavit. It's deficient in a significant way, but there is still a minimal nexus here that will allow an officer to objectively rely on it. And what I'd like to point to is
maybe we can all look at it together.
Yes,
you and I can look at it together. Where is it in the joint appendix?
It is
17.
16 and 17.
Okay.
You say there's a minimal nexus.
It's very minimal. It's very minimal, and I don't want to overemphasize this, but there is a reference to possession of a regulated firearm by a minor. There are only two minors named in the affidavit, Joe Goode and Colin McKenzie Goode. Colin McKenzie Goode and Joseph Yevsukov. And then the only other person or location that's mentioned is the informant, Ludmila Yevsukov. So I think it's a reasonable inference that it's not her location that's being sought to be searched, because she's, in fact, bringing this information to the attention of the officers. So if you read that last paragraph of the affidavit in conjunction with the charge...
On page 17.
On page 17, yes. The last paragraph of the affidavit talks about how Colin McKenzie Goode is 18 years of age. He's a minor. And Patrick Yevsukov is 17 years old. They're a minor in the sense of the statute with respect to the possession of this AK-47. And you look at the charge here, it's possession of a regulated firearm by a minor. So I would submit, this is thin, I don't want to overstretch this, but it would be a reasonable inference for an officer looking at this to make that the Joe Goode and Colin McKenzie Goode referred to in the last paragraph are in fact individuals who reside at that location. Now, I don't want to overstate this, and if the court is not convinced by this argument that there's at least a minimal nexus here, then we would ask the court to address what you called the difficult question back when this court initially faced the situation in the Bynum decision. And we'd ask you to find that additional facts, which the officers knew and which were shown, it's undisputed, to have been known by the officers at the time the affidavit was executed, that those can be considered as part of the Leon analysis.
Well, let me just go back to your first argument. If we don't have, if the officers who signed the affidavit had died, and we have no testimony from them about what they knew or didn't know, do you maintain that this application is sufficient?
No.
Okay.
What if it's...
So that we need the... evidence and the concession, the correct concession by the other side, that they did have this evidence, in fact, in hand.
I think we'd be hard pressed to argue otherwise.
And
I think this
to
is
have them being the executing officers, wouldn't you?
Yes.
I think you would need the executing officers.
You need the the officers who made the affidavit, but who left something material out of it, to be doing the executing.
Yes, Your Honor.
In order to be able to rely, if that's good law, on what they knew.
That's correct.
Over and above what they wrote down.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you need to be able to come to court and say that.
Or have some...
Not everything's in the affidavit. We
That's
made
correct.
A mistake. We, in fact, knew these additional facts that cleaned the thing up, and we relied on those when we executed the thing.
Some objective basis to rely.
To show the good faith.
That's correct.
See, the problem is, though, we've set up this elaborate thing where we go to the magistrate, and the magistrate makes a decision. It's sort of like, well, we do that, except... when we don't, and when we make a mistake. And there's something that seems wrong about that.
Leon has always considered, though, that the totality of the circumstances
yes,
ought to
but
be something
you, but part of the Leon thing is that the magistrate has blessed it. And the magistrate, we give that blessing a high degree of proof. Now we have the blessing of something which you've conceded is no good.
To hold otherwise, it would lead to exactly the anomaly, though, that Your Honor pointed out
in
the Bynum decision.
The anomaly.
You know, and the anomaly is something. I was rereading the Leon decision last night, and one of the things that struck me is that at the very beginning of Leon itself, the court points out that particularly when law enforcement officers have acted in objective good faith or their transgressions have been minor, the magnitude of the benefit conferred on a guilty defendant offends basic concepts of the criminal justice system. And I think that's the concern here, and that's why I raised in the 28J letter some of the recent decisions, Herring and Davis, which go to sort of the heart of ultimately what the court has to decide here is whether or not...
The on principle is to get out from under the... government losing evidence as a result of simple mistakes.
That's correct. And that's what I would characterize what's happened here, an isolated incident of negligence, the kind of thing that even at the beginning of Leon itself, they weren't contemplating that it would be suppression would occur in circumstances such as what we have in the instant case. And so I think in the Herring decision...
I'm sorry. Let's see if I understand that. What you're saying is... that you don't need to get to Leon to affirm here because Leon doesn't really have any relevance here because Leon is talking about good faith about what you put in front of the magistrate. And this is some other way to save a bad application.
I think Leon was...
I'm talking about the Leon good faith part. You say we don't go there because we don't... because, of course, you can't get anything out of the fact that the magistrate blessed this because you recognize it's no good.
I think I'm not willing to abandon the Leon argument, but I also think that Leon should be read and understood with the question of suppression in mind. It's sort of an overarching concern here as well, whether suppression is an appropriate remedy at all. And so,
well, we know it's don't we know? Hasn't the Supreme Court told us that sometimes things do get suppressed?
Oh, certainly. But, okay. But it has to have some
so
kind
it's not
of,
like they've done away with that.
No, but the question is whether or not there's any deterrent effect. And I think in this case it's clear that there's nothing that could be done to deter these officers. This is a simple, isolated mistake. It's not reckless disregard. It's not an attempt to slide something in bad faith by the judge. It's simply here a question of an oversight. It's what I think Judge...
the oversight was not putting the address in the affidavit?
Yes, it's what...
They put it in the warrant.
They did.
On the face of the warrant, they knew where to go.
That's correct.
But what they failed to do is make the link.
Right.
That's correct. And that would tie back into the Grove...
Once they got the warrant, they had to go there.
Well, they have it
they
in
had
the application.
In their hands to
they have the address.
Order them to go there.
They have the address in the application.
That's correct. There's actually, I think on page 15 of the joint appendix, we have actually what's the warrant cover sheet. And then on 16, it's what they've termed the application.
At 16, the top of 16, they have the address.
Incorporates the address. And so again, this goes back to sort of the argument I was making at the beginning, is that it's a reasonable inference to presume that in light of the charge and the presence of the address at the beginning and the fact that there are only two minors mentioned, one is Mr. Mackenzie Goody and the other is Joseph Yesukov, it's a reasonable inference to make that that's the location in which the defendant, Colin Mackenzie Goody, resided at. It's not a substantial nexus, and I don't want the court to get the impression that we're arguing that. What I'm arguing is, for the purposes of addressing the question of Leon, I think we can look at this and see, well, the officer could have had objectively relied on this in good faith. And then if the court is unsatisfied with that, then I would ask the court to turn outside of the four corners of the warrant and consider the objective circumstances surrounding what was going on in this case.
Now, what if you had a officer or two officers, say, who weren't involved in the affidavit, but they've been given the warrant by the chief, and who said, we got a search warrant here just been authorized by the district circuit judge of Montgomery County, and the officers that got it, we had to do another emergency, I want you fellas to go execute this thing.
I think so. Your Honor is referring to a hypothetical situation in which the officers would know nothing about the outside circumstances other than what's on the face of the affidavit.
They wouldn't even have the affidavit. They got the warrant. The warrant says go to 6312 Rockhurst Road, Bethesda, and search for this stuff. All these things are described in detail in here.
I think those officers.
The warrant that's been issued.
I think
they go do it.
I think knowing that the magistrate has issued the warrant and it's been ratified and they have, I think they'd be, there would be no problem with them executing
it. But I thought you told us just not less than 10 minutes ago that it had to be the same people that asked for the warrant executing it.
I did say.
Is that right?
Yeah. I did say.
That was to get the additional knowledge.
That was correct.
But
that's
you're backing up and you're saying that even if they don't have the additional knowledge, if they and they only have the warrant, they have to go execute it because on the face of it, it tells them to go execute it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But that doesn't see that. Don't you think that goes too far? I mean, that just seems to me to be so subject to abuse.
I think what I would ask
put
the court
an inadequate application in.
What I would ask
get
the,
it.
What I would ask the court to do would be to limit the decision to what the facts in this case are here today. And I recognize this
next
is a retreat.
Next year you'll be here with this next case.
Perhaps, Your Honor, and that would have to be decided based upon what those particular facts held. But
with respect to the facts here, do we know who the executing officers were? Do we know that the executing officers were the officers who made the affidavit?
There is the officers who executed the affidavit?
Yes.
Yes,
were
Your Honor.
The same as the ones who actually executed the warrant?
I don't know if that's reflected in the record, Your Honor.
Well,
I was looking at
the
return refers to some other officers with respect to the seizing.
Maybe they're the ones who did execute. Maybe that's the scenario we have here.
I did not see these officers referenced specifically in the return, if that's the question. And so I don't know if the record indicates what the precise situation was here.
You're not asking us if we limit it to the facts of this case. You don't have the facts that you.
The issue is whether any officer would be obliged to go execute this warrant.
Yes, Your Honor.
And permitted.
Or whether he should think, well, looking at the face of the warrant, there's something wrong with it.
The facts outside, there's a letter by Ludmila Yevsikov that I believe is addressed to the entire police department, and that is in the record. And I think it's a reasonable inference then.
I see what you're saying.
Yes.
Okay.
That's on the joint appendix at page 84K. The July 27, 2008 letter, it's addressed to the entire police force, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the Maryland State Police Headquarters. And so I think it would be a reasonable inference that that information then was in the possession of all of the officers who were involved in the investigation. I think it's a doubly reasonable inference to make when you look at the fact that the actual narrative that's contained in the affidavit bears a substantial similarity to what's contained in that letter in terms of what they chose to include in the affidavit itself. And so
well,
I think
the executing officers don't know anything that's in the affidavit, but they got the warrant in their hands.
Can you ask?
The circuit judge of Montgomery County has just issued a warrant telling them where to go with specificity and what to search for. And they do it. Now, does that implicate Leon at all?
I think the Leon question turns again on the reliance on the of the affidavit itself and not on the warrant. Mm-hmm. And so I think they'd have to have to address the question properly,
well,
you'd have
good
to look
faith, if an officer has a warrant signed by a judicial officer, what are his choices?
At that point, he doesn't. There's nothing he can do to go back and have the judge modify it.
Well, does he have any basis? What basis would he have to challenge it? I mean, if he has a warrant, what reason does he have to go behind it?
He would have no reason to go behind it, Your Honor.
Does he have any choice but to execute it?
No, he has no choice but to execute at that point.
What he could be disciplined.
That's correct. There's an order of the court.
Well, there are lots of times when officers go back and put more information into the application. I've seen those cases.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, you said they can't go back. They can go back.
No, they can't challenge. They can't go back. They can't go back behind the warrant and question whether it was issued legitimately or question sort of what they've got an order of the court. It's signed, and they'd have to honor that.
Well, they don't have to honor it. They could go back and ask for put more information in it. Say, I've seen a lot of situations where they say we made a mistake here, didn't put all our information in. We have more information. Here's a new request. I bet you've seen those cases.
Yes, Your Honor. But in this case, I would submit again, limiting it to the facts of this case, the reliance at this point was reasonable.
But you're limiting it doesn't go any far because now we've gone from the position that the people that made out the request were the people that executed the warrant to the position that they might have been to the position that they weren't.
I think there's some support in the record for the fact that the officers these officers were part of a group of people who were informed by Ludmila Yesukov about the facts that were contained in this warrant.
There were more than two that went executed. Right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And Michael, in fairness, because I may have led you astray, I mean, I think the question contemplated an officer receiving the warrant, an officer receiving a sworn warrant would probably not have any reason to go back and feel inclined to provide additional information for an affidavit.
That's correct. That's correct, Your Honor.
It does happen because sometimes they recognize that it's improper. I mean, they're interested in getting especially
certainly,
if they have the information.
But I believe, if I understood correctly, the question that was being posed, it would simply be a question of whether or not if they just had the four corners of the warrant itself, not including the affidavit, but just the warrant.
My
yeah,
that but they just have the warrant and this warrant, and there's nothing wrong with the face of it.
There's nothing wrong with the face of that warrant.
What are their options? Well, do we have to go beyond it and just go see if there's something defective about it that we don't know about?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe they have any obligation to do that. Are there any additional questions from the panel?
She's had enough questions. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure, Your Honor. Thank you.
If I could just address the point about the officers who obtained the warrant versus the officers who executed the warrant. Your Honor, I don't think that is really relevant. I think that's an issue that is foreclosed by Leon itself. If you look at
what does Leon have to do with it if the officers get the warrant and it's sufficient on its face? Don't they have to go execute it?
Well, I think ordinarily they would, although I think they should take the time to read it because they should know.
They read it, and they believe that it's sufficient on its face from their training, and it's signed by a circuit court judge in Montgomery County, Maryland.
Right.
And they're in Montgomery County, Maryland.
Well, I understand that they may very well go execute it. They might not even think about it a whole lot. They may hear, well, here it is, but the issue is, after the fact, if someone files a motion to suppress, then what's going to happen? I understand that they may feel compelled to do it, and I understand from what Judge Motz is saying.
An appeal up here.
Right. So, exactly. But that's
maybe a helpful way to look at it is remember that Supreme Court case that you were relying on so heavily in your original argument. Why don't you lay that beside this one with respect to the information that was available to the people that were executing the warrant?
Yes. Back to Grove versus Ramirez.
So it didn't have any information about what they were to search for.
Right. Just as here, there's no nexus between.
Well, but you're told the address. So you,
sure.
On its face, you have all the information you need to execute the warrant. You're told the address.
Right.
And you're told the name of the person. And you're told the
what to search
what you're
for.
Searching for. And you didn't have that in the Supreme Court case.
No, you didn't. I agree. I'm not saying it's exactly the same, Your Honor.
No, I know. But what I'm trying to do is to sort of tease out
but I think,
what is important here.
I think what is important is the Supreme Court said, even though all of the good information was actually in the application, you can't look to that. You cannot look outside the warrant itself.
But the question wasn't directed toward the affidavit. I mean, the question really was directed toward the warrant. And you have been describing what was facially defective about the warrant in
Right.
Groh. And I think the question is, how does that analogy play out on these facts?
It plays out because Leon itself talks about four circumstances, as Your Honor noted earlier, and one of them, the third one, which is the one applicable here, is that where the affidavit is what we call a bare-bones affidavit, that no reasonable police – it's right here in Leon. I don't know quite else how to explain it, unless you're going to read the third exception of Leon out of Leon.
But I think the question was the initial question was, aren't we past Leon when we have a facially valid warrant?
No, I don't believe so. And just to quickly follow up on my point about it doesn't matter who the executing officer is versus who the – if you look at footnote 24, in terms of the court in Leon, they're describing who the officer is. It's sort of in a slightly different context, but they're saying nothing in our opinion suggests, for example, that an officer could obtain a warrant on the basis of a bare-bones affidavit and then rely on colleagues who are ignorant of the circumstances under which the warrant was obtained to conduct the search. I mean, I guess that's kind of the flip side of what we have here, but I think...
But Leon, I misunderstand Leon. I always thought that it meant that evidence obtained pursuant to a search warrant issued by a neutral magistrate doesn't need to be excluded if the officer's reliance on the warrant was objectively reasonable.
Absolutely.
All right. And that's the warrant. That doesn't say anything about the affidavit. The affidavit is like in this instance, it's page 1670.
Right.
The warrant is page 615. And there's nothing wrong with the warrant. At least that's the prosecutor and I agreed with it. You agree there's nothing wrong with the warrant? It says
facially
to go.
Right.
Tells them what to search for. It's beyond Groh completely.
Right.
It tells them exactly what to search for.
But there has to be probable cause supporting
the
warrant.
The judge has signed that. He's already certified that by signing it. I hereby find there exists probable cause to authorize a search and seizure as follows, signed by the circuit judge of Montgomery County.
Well, again, just to quote Leon, again, one of the exceptions to the Leon exception, nor would an officer manifest objective good faith in relying on a warrant based on an affidavit so lacking in indicia of probable cause as to render official belief in its existence entirely unreasonable.
If the officer doesn't know anything about the affidavit, he can't know that it relied on an affidavit.
But I think he has.
All he knows is that the warrant's there in front of him or in his hand, and it was signed by the judge.
But I guess your rejoinder to that would be that that's too big a hole to let the prosecutor go through or the police go through, because they always then have some officers making these applications and other officers who don't know anything about the case
right.
executing them, and never the twain shall meet.
And I think
in other words, the first people can be acting in bad faith
right.
and putting inadequate information in, and the second people can be acting in entirely good faith because they've got a signed order from the magistrate.
And that's what footnote 24.
So, but then the way you would marry that is to show that the first people acted in good faith, right? And I think you virtually, the people that got to put in the application, and I think you virtually conceded that they did act in good faith.
Well, Your Honor, well, hopefully, I don't want to misconstrue what Your Honor is thinking and what I'm saying. All I'm saying is, as a matter of reality, out there in the real world, right. the officers had done enough investigation to know where does this Mackenzie Goody live? No, it's Rockhurst, but that's really not a relevant issue, Your Honor.
If the situation had been
they have no idea where he lives, and they put in 16 addresses, and they make a warrant for 16 addresses, not saying he lived at any one of them, because he really did. They just don't really know.
Right.
It could be kind of anywhere in the, or 500 addresses. And then there was a warrant issued for each one of them. We'd have a valid warrant on its face, but maybe we'd have a very different situation with respect to the good faith in the application.
I don't think we'd have, as a matter of law, we would not have a different situation. I think it's the same situation.
Okay. Other questions? Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll come down and greet the lawyers, and then we'll go directly to our next case.